Mr. Adamson, Reel 6. You're now with a new unit, in effect. Are there any memories of incidents that occurred whilst you were with them?
I think the best thing that I remember with the Northumberland Fusiliers, we did a 6 weeks intensive training stint on the Carlisle Race Course. It involved a lot of ceremonial work and things like that. But I think the thing that came outstanding with that was suddenly one of the senior NCOs found that I had an athletic ability, which I didn't think I had. And nevertheless, he detected that we used to go for PE maybe once or twice a week to one of the side roads some 2 or 3 miles away from the Carlisle race course, and there we would probably march up to that point and do extensive PE, and at the end of it the PE NCO would say, right, first one back to camp. And we used to run back to the camp, the 2 or 3 miles, whichever the case may be. And for whatever reason, I was always first one back. And after a while, one of the senior NCOs suddenly pulled me to one side. He says, I'm going to enter you for the cross-country run on such and such a day. I said, I'm not capable of doing that. He said, every day when you go out to PE and the first one back after the, you get dismissed on the road, you're always first one back. He said, that suggests to me, he said, you've got some athletic ability. So he said, I've entered you for it. And the remarkable thing was that I won that cross-country run. And that spurred me on to other athletic events. Mile, and that was an outstanding feature, which my introduction into the Northumberland Fusiliers.
Did you stay at Hutton Gate with the Northumberland Fusiliers?
No, we eventually, the whole regiment moved down onto the Isle of Wight.
When would this be?
42. And we moved down onto the Isle of Wight, and while I was on the Isle of Wight with the regiment, and of course there were some very pleasant incidents on the Isle of Wight, being so far south as we were, as opposed to being up in the north of England, and not having ventured very much out of town as a boy. This was something completely new to me, and to the Isle of Wight, it was like the garden isle to me. But while I was on the Isle of Wight, I notice an ACI on the notice board, ACI being an Army Councillor's instruction. And it was on the notice board, and it was looking for volunteers for the Royal Army Service Corps as drivers. And I'd always had an inclination towards driving from going into the territories, as a matter of fact, although I never became a driver until I virtually qualified through them, although I had a driving licence. I'd just done a local test. Nevertheless, I decided to apply for this ACI to join the this ACI appeared on the notice board, so I decided to apply for a transfer into the Royal Army Service Corps, which was eventually granted. But the one thing that I had to do, previous to being transferred, I had to relinquish my trade pay, because as a tradesman, there was a different set of rules applied under Army Council's instruction. So I relinquished my trade pay, applied through the ACI that was on the notice board, and eventually was allowed to transfer to the Royal Army Service Corps. And eventually sent from, I think our headquarters was at a place called Shanklin on the Isle of Wight.
Just before we go on with that, you were down on the Isle of Wight, I think you said?
Yeah.
With the Searchlight people. Was there any activity down there? Or?
Well, the obvious activity was the raids on Southampton and Portsmouth, which we saw quite a lot of. And quite often, if aircraft coming back from the raids, the German aircraft coming back from the raids, were being picked up by searchlights on the Isle of Wight.
And these would include your searchlights?
Yes.
Do you recall any particular...
Quite often they would come down and stuff them with machine gun fire and things like that. But I can't honestly remember any real fatalities or anything like that.
Were you strafed yourselves?
Oh, yes. Quite often there was strafing. And in those days, the protection on the site had graduated to a much more sophisticated machine gun. Instead of the old Browning gun, it used to be on the early days. Sorry, the Lewis gun, which used to be on the early days, they were then equipped with twin Browning guns, which were fired not from a magazine, but from a belt-fed supply. And they were operated, there was a left and a right-hand machine, and these allowed the one operator to fire the twin guns together. I won't say it was ever with any real effect other than a deterrent more than anything else. But that was an improvement from the Lewis gun.
Was this night strafing coming down
more
on your light?
More often than not, yes, because the searchlights were alight on the night.
That must have been rather frightening, surely.
Oh, yeah.
What happened when an enemy plane was coming down firing its gun? Did you retain the searchlight?
Well, they were trying to extinguish the searchlight, and we were trying to pick them up so they could, as long as we could.
You didn't.
And quite often,
it.
If we were firing back at them, they suddenly realised they were getting like for like, and probably after not being able to put the light out, they would probably climb at altitude and disappear into the sky and away back over to Germany.
You didn't scatter when the aircraft guns started firing on you.
Incidentally, if I can go back slightly on some of the activity of the searchlight, as well as being our duty being to illuminate enemy aircraft in cases of an aircraft raid, which then allowed anti-aircraft guns to fire visually rather than using the radar system. We were quite often called upon what I would probably call a mercy mission. And this is when aircraft, our own aircraft, were coming back from raids, and I'm talking about maybe one, two, maybe more. They were coming back to work to aerodromes, probably not so many miles away from the environment of the regiment's scope. We were asked to lay down what they called a path, and searchlights were picked up from as near to the coast as possible, and selected sites would be put down, and you used to illuminate your searchlight. But you used to drop it down to as low a level as possible so that our own aircraft coming back from a raid, badly damaged, with a lot of the facilities being out of action, were able to come in and pick a path of searchlights from the course to their own aerodrome and land safely. And on more than one occasion, searchlight crews were actually invited back to aerodromes where the aircraft had actually landed safely, and they were given, an appreciation by the aircraft crews, the aerodrome commanders, and such like. So we had a twofold purpose as a search light unit. You were either to detect the enemy aircraft or assist our own aircraft to get back safely to the aerodrome. That's digressing slightly from what we were talking about.
Did clouds have an effect on an air
search
light? What were the problems then?
Well, more often than not, if there was a fairly low cloud base and the enemy were above it, as the searchlight hit the cloud base, instead of it may have penetrated, we don't know, I don't know. But what it used to do is it illuminate the whole of the cloud, so you finished up with an illuminated umbrella over the whole of the area. And quite often, if the cloud base was too low, it was inadvisable to strike arc and light the searchlights, as it were.
And presumably in those cases, enemy planes wouldn't come below that
low cloud base.
It would be getting too low for them.
No.
So you decided to join the Royal Army Service Corps. What date would this be?
Early 1942, I think it would be.
And you were on the Isle of Wight, I think you said.
On the Isle of Wight, and I moved, along with a number of other people that had done the same thing. We moved up to a place called Darley Dale in Derbyshire.
And what happened to you there?
Well, there I went through the formal training as an RASC driver, and I passed out as an RASC driver.
What form did that training take?
Basic training on car engines, lorry engines and things like that, maintenance procedures and so forth. And then also you went out with a qualified driver. Quite often you were at the wheel. You didn't know what kind of a truck you were going to drive on the day. There were several trucks of different makes, American, British, Canadian, and you drove that truck until you satisfied the examiner that you were qualified to drive, and then on the strength of that you went on a normal driving test. And I remember, I think I had to sit the test twice, so a rather slight ignorance on my part, I should probably think it was. And the driving test took place in the town of Chesterfield. And unfortunately, most of the driving that I did there was in and around the market area and so forth. And I kept coming to this particular road junction, and I was coming up to it in a certain gear and stopping, putting it in neutral, putting the handbrake on, looking both ways, engaging it in the gear, and then handbrake off and turning. And apparently I was supposed to have geared down from fourth to third to second and then stop. And it was only after it was pointed out to me that I eventually did that, and I passed my tests. Once you'd passed your test on the site, you then allocated postings to various RASC companies, and unfortunately a lot of the lads that I was very friendly with, one in particular, had in fact been posted. And we moved from the driver training company to what was known as a holding company, and these were people who had already passed the test and were waiting dispatch to a working company.
Where was this?
This was just outside of Darley Dale. I'm just trying to think of the name of the place. I forget what it was now. But it was only a few miles away from the main driving training establishment. And I remember talking to the regimental sergeant major one morning about postings. He says, "Oh, just bide your time, son, just bide your time." And I explained that one of my friends had already left. I had no idea where he'd gone to. So I asked the RSM if there was any chance of him being posted to that particular company with him. And he said, "I'm afraid not, lad." He said, "They only wanted so many and they've got the numbers." So he said, "You'll just have to wait till such times as a posting suitable for you comes along." But unfortunately, most of the time spent in the holding company was actually doing rather duties such as spud bashing and things like that, the sort of menial task that one doesn't think about wanting to do, and if you can get out of them, you did. Anyway, after a few weeks, the RSM said, "I've got something that might interest you, Adamson." I said, "Yes, sir, what is it?" "I'd like to do a motorcycle course." I said, "Motorcycle course?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, if it'll get me off these duties for a week," the answer is, "Yes, I'll take it." He said, "I'll put your name down." And the following week, I was sent on a motorcycle course. So I went through the instructions of how to handle a motorbike and eventually passed out as a motorcyclist as well. So I was able to drive a lorry, I was able to drive a motorcycle. And then shortly after they completed the course, the RSM said, "Got a posting for you, Adamson." He said, "I think you'll enjoy it. You're going to a tank transporter company." I had no idea what a tank transporter company was till I arrived there and saw the huge lorries with 26 and 30 foot long trailers on the back, some of the trailers had anything up to 24 wheels on them. The lorries themselves were stood about somewhere in the region about 8 or 9 foot high, and they were massive things, and I enjoyed my time with them.
What was the name of this unit?
For the life of me, I can't remember the name of the unit. It was a tank transporter company, that's all I can remember about it.
And what were your duties there? What were you doing?
We used to go to ordnance factories, pick tanks up, they were loaded on the back of the trailer, and we would then transport them to a tank regiment or to a base near to a tank regiment where they could be picked up by their own transporters and things like that.
What make were these huge trucks, these huge trailer trucks?
Originally, there were two types of truck, actually. There were a truck where actually they didn't use a trailer, but the actual lorry was of such a length and such strength as well, that it was able to take the smaller tank on the back. And there were two huge ramps of about 7 or 8 foot long, which were stood up like columns on the back of the lorry. And these were eventually lowered down and allowed the tank to be loaded up on the back.
And was that driven?
And those types of lorry were known as Macs and Whites, and they were American lorries. But then they progressed to another American lorry known as the Diamond T, and the Diamond T were a massive thing, really large, and you could carry anything on the back of the trailers or anything up to 100 ton on them. They were massive things.
They must have had quite a high proportion of gears.
Yes, there were five gears, and then within the gearbox itself, it had also a high and low ratio, and the low ratio gave you another five gears. So virtually all in all, you had 10 forward gears and 2 reverse gears, because the ratio played in the high and the low ratio also applied to the reverse gear. So you had the equivalent of 10 forward gears until reverse gears.
At what speed would you be able to travel at with a heavy tank on your back?
Generally speaking, anything between 3 and 10 miles an hour. And if you got above that, it was because you weren't in gear.
Getting round some of the narrow roads and through towns and villages must have been difficult.
It was. When I first joined this company, and I was allocated to a driver, a little Welsh lad. His name will come to me, something Evans. But we assigned this detail. We were stationed, incidentally, on the north of London at a place called Barnet. And this particular day, we were in houses. We weren't in wooden billets or anything like that. We were in houses which had been built and never occupied on the part of an estate in Barnet itself. And this particular day, Taffy Evans, for the want of a better Christian name, Taffy Evans said, "Right, we're going out on detail. Get your gear, put it on the back of the wagon." We used to sleep on the back of the wagon, or we had a sort of lean-to bivouac tent, which used to be fastened to the side of the wagon. All our gear went on the wagon, and I jumped into the spare driver's seat, or as it was known as the trailer man's seat. But I jumped in there, and Taffy stood on the same side. He said, "You're on the wrong seat, son." I looked, I said, "No, I'm the trailer man." He said, "When you're with me, there is no trailer man. We are both drivers. You get in, you drive." And suddenly I'm faced with the task of taking a Diamond T unit with a 24 foot long Rogers trailer on the back. There were two types of trailers, a Rogers trailer and a Diamond trailer, Dyson trailer. And the only way you could tell the difference, or the one way you could tell the difference between the two, was the actual shape of the blocks which used to lower down on the back of the trailer onto the floor to enable you to load a tank. And where the Rogers trailer was more of a rounded fashion, the Dyson trailer was pretty square and almost like a triangle. And Taffy turned and he said to me, "You drive, I'm the trailer man." And of course I had to drive the unit. And I was suddenly out on the road with the Diamond T in the trailer. And Taffy laughing his head off at me, making all the usual mistakes of a new driver with a lorry of that length. But nevertheless, I eventually became as competent in driving it as he was.
What was the job of the trailer person next to you?
You got out. You dropped the back blocks, which were automatically fastened to the trailer chassis. You dropped the back blocks that enabled the tank to climb up onto the back of the trailer. You undid all the shackles, which were incidentally fastened to the trailer. You undone the shackles to allow the tank to be shackled down to the trailer once it was loaded on. So basically, that was what the trailer man's job was supposed to do. But with Taffy as a mate, we both shared that responsibility. There was no driver and trailer man. We were both drivers, we were both trailer men. And when we came to whatever location we were going to get tanks loaded on, we both did an equal share of the duties. Loaded the tank on, fastened the tank down, put the chocks back up again into the regular lock position. And whichever case may be, Taff would say, "Well, you can drive it so far and I'll do the rest, or I'll drive it so far." And we had a very good understanding between us, actually, Taffy and I.
Were tanks driven up onto the trailer?
In a lot of cases that weren't supposed to be, the instructions generally speaking were that you winch the tailor on, and usually you worked in pairs. When I say pairs, there were two lorries. You had a winch on the front of the trailer, you had a winch on the back of the unit. And what was supposed to happen was that the winch on the back of the unit would winch the tank onto the trailer, but another lorry with a winch on the front, which was stationed behind, would also be fastened to that unit, and it was sort of paid out and paid in with the two. But later on, we started to drive them onto the tanks for speed more than anything else.
What happened to you next, then, after being in London?
Well, I stopped with them. I eventually went abroad with them, actually. But once the necessity of them being used on the continent, we suddenly decided that we'd be transferred, and we were actually transferred to what was known as a GT company, that was General Transport, and your duties were mixed.
You say you went abroad with them. Where did you go?
I went over to France and Germany.
What date would this be?
Sometime in August in 1944.
Well, just after the invasion?
Yeah.
And what were you doing there when you first got over?
Well, we started transport. When we went over as a tank transporter unit, we were moving stuff that was at the beachheads and taking them further forward. And then after a while, as the beachheads moved further inland, the necessity to do that no longer existed. And in fact, the tanks were being moved forward by Royal Tank Regiments. And what we did then was we transferred leftover equipment that would probably be taken back to Britain, but we then transferred into General Transport duties.
What were the beaches, what were the conditions of the beaches whilst you were when you first got there?
There was still a lot of cluttered equipment laid about, but generally speaking, when we landed, it was okay. We went ashore and went up onto the roads without any problems.
Do you remember the area that you were in?
Bayer. Round about Bayer, around that area.
How did you cope with wrong side of the road driving and narrow Normandy lanes?
Strange enough, there wasn't a lot of opposition transport on the roads, civilian transport. So if there was any transport coming the opposite way, it was usually British transport. I equipped myself to driving on the right-hand side of the road quite easily, actually. I never found it a problem. And in fact, I was stationed over there from August 1944 to sometime in April of 1946, and I drove